CJ Radio International presents the longest-running international show, The Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome again to another edition of your program, Happy Station, from PCJ Radio International. Now, before we actually begin, I'd like to do a shout-out now to Timothy Zamora. Yes, Timothy Zamora. On May the 7th, he posted on our Patreon page a delicious segment featuring those Dutch barrel organs as previously heard or even newer material would bring a smile to my face. Well, Timothy, as you're probably aware, we did begin with a little bit of barrel organ music today, which is another theme that we use for the program. So, look at it this way. What you just heard over the last, let's say, 1 minute and 51 seconds is something that is more to come. Actually, you know, barrel organs are interesting, especially when you have a piece of music that you would never dream, you would never imagine being played on a barrel organ. You know, I mean, strange stuff. And I remember how long ago, I can't remember how long ago now, possibly, I think, certainly more than 4 years ago, we played a piece of music, played on a barrel organ, and it was strange, because it was Michael Jackson's Thriller. Yes, Michael Jackson's Thriller played on a barrel organ. I mean, in reality, I suppose you can play any kind of music on a barrel organ. But I'm wondering if that is really true. I mean, if you take something like Bjork, who is rather experimental, would it work? Because there are so many different sounds in her works. Or, I just thought of another piece that could be played on the barrel organ that would be rather interesting. The song Suzanne by Leonard Cohen. And here it is. No, I'm just joking. We don't have that. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I suppose there are pieces that would work, or rather wouldn't work so well, that would sound very strange. But anyway, Timothy, yes, we are going to be doing a very special barrel organ program coming up, actually very soon. And we will be posting it on our Patreon page. There's a few other things that I want to tell you about, but first let's begin with Claude François and Si j'avais un marteau. which translates into English, "If I had a hammer."
Je cognerai le jour, je cognerai la nuit, j'y mettrai tout mon cœur, je bâtirai une ferme, une grange et une barrière, et j'y mettrai mon père, ma mère, mes frères et mes sœurs. Oh, oh, ce serait le bonheur.
Tout le monde chante encore.
Oh, 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 oh.
Plus fort.
Oh, 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 oh.
Encore plus fort.
Oh, oh.
Une cloche, je sonnerai le jour, je sonnerai la nuit, j'y mettrai tout mon cœur, pour le travail à l'aube, et le soir pour la soupe, j'appellerai mon père, ma mère, mes frères et mes sœurs, oh, oh, ce serait le bonheur.
On chante tous en cœur.
Oh, 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 oh.
Oui, c'est ça.
Oh, oh.
Chanson, j'achanterai le jour, j'achanterai la nuit, j'y mettrai tout mon cœur, en retournant la terre, pour alléger nos peines, je la chanterai à mon père, ma mère, mes frères et mes sœurs, oh, oh, ce serait le bonheur.
Tout le monde chante encore une fois.
Oh, 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 oh.
Plus fort.
Oh, 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 oh.
Toujours plus fort.
Oh, oh.
Un marteau, et si j'avais une cloche, puis si j'avais une chanson à chanter, je serais le plus heureux. Je ne voudrais rien d'autre qu'un marteau, une cloche et une chanson. Pour l'amour de mon père, ma mère, mes frères et mes sœurs,
oh oh, ce serait le bonheur.
C'est le marteau du courage, c'est la cloche de la liberté. Mais la chanson c'est pour mon père, ma mère, mes frères et mes sœurs.
Oh, oh, oh.
Pour moi c'est le bonheur, c'est ça le vrai bonheur. Si j'avais un marteau, si j'avais un marteau.
Claude François avec Si j'avais un marteau, If I Had a Hammer. Beginning today's edition of Happy Station from PCJ Radio International. Now, I want to tell you about something, rather special that we are working on, and it's something that we want your help in. We are planning a special two-hour Happy Station. Yes, a special two-hour Happy Station. And this, of course, is to thank all of those who have become part of our Patreon family, which I'll tell you a little bit more later on in the program at patreon.com/PCJ Radio. And we're going to have a special two-hour edition of Happy Station, and we want, well, your input on the output that we actually have on the program. So, we have some questions. Well, actually, not even questions. Would you like to take part? First of all, what would you like to hear? Or would you like to submit something? Now, it's very easy to do. Just go to patreon.com/PCJ Radio. And you will see a link there. And that's it. Just put your ideas down, and we will do our best to go through all of them, and then decide which ones we want to use, and put something together. So, it should be a lot of fun, and we hope that all of you will actually partake in it. We'll have another song, and then when we come back, I want to tell you about our Patreon page, because we've had, Actually, a lot of people asking about what kind of things they could hear. For those who haven't already gone, it actually is a wide variety of stuff. And we just actually uploaded another Happy Station show this week from the past, which is just very, very, very a lot of fun. But first, let's take a listen to The Eurythmics. And it is a song that became a big hit for them, especially for Annie Lennox, who does have a fantastic voice. And she's doing very different material now than she was doing way, way, way back in the 1980s. Here she is with Dave Stewart, her partner in crime in The Eurythmics, with Sweet Dreams Are Made of These.
Sweet dreams are made of
Eurythmics and Sweet Dreams. Sweet Dreams are made of these, so I hope you all have sweet dreams. I haven't been sleeping too well this past week. Mind you, I don't sleep that well anyway, only because I thought that I was coming down with a cold earlier this week, and then I realized, and I still don't sound 100% perfect today, but I realized actually that it isn't a cold, that in fact is allergies, which are driving me absolutely bonkers, because the medicine that I'm taking, which is supposed to help, doesn't help in any way, shape, or form. It just keeps me awake, which is kind of goes against the idea of actually taking the medicine for it. Anyway, before this, I was telling you about our Patreon page and about our good friend Timothy, who said that he would like to, you know, hear some barrel organ music on the special program that we are going to be putting together. Well, Timothy, actually, we just uploaded something on Friday, and you probably already know about it. If you don't, go and check it out, because it is a... Well, we're going to play an excerpt from the show. It's an original Happy Station show that was broadcast September the 18th, 1988. It was recorded at the Open Air Museum in Arnhem. And the first piece of music on that show is actually a barrel organ piece. So I know that we began our theme today with a piece of barrel organ music, so we're going to dedicate another one to you. Oh, you are a special person. I know that sounds more sarcastic than what it is actually supposed to be. I'm just being silly. But anyway, I enjoy being silly. It's fun. Anyway, here's an excerpt from that program.
We certainly hope that for all of you who are celebrating something today or tomorrow, even yesterday, it will definitely be a very happy day. With Jack Stickfoot, ladies and gentlemen, I had come to a part of the history...
An excerpt of Happy Station from September the 18th, 1988, which is now available through our Patreon page. Just go to patreon.com/PCJ Radio. And if you become a patron at Patreon, you will be able to listen to that full program. So go there now. Yes, go there now. I would like to welcome somebody who is now a patron at Patreon, who can have, who can listen to all the archive material from Happy Station, including Radio Nederland and other special programs as well. And he is somebody, actually, whose name I'm almost 100% certain that I have seen that name before. From either sending in a reception report or contacting us via email. And his name is Dennis DeMarco. Dennis DeMarco. Hello, Dennis. And thank you. You are a new patron at our Patreon page, patreon.com/PCJ Radio. All righty. Time now for music. And then when we come back, something to do with intelligence. Now, you're thinking, well, Keith, you're not intelligent, which you're absolutely right. I would agree with you on that one. But no, not that kind of intelligence, a different kind of intelligence. You know, the spying James Bond kind of intelligence. But first, let's take a listen to Desmond Dekker and the Israelites.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Call me Israelite, sir. Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Darling, she said I was yours to receive.
Oh, the Israelite.
Shut them a tear up choices ago. I don't want to end up like Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, the Israelite.
After a storm, there must be a calm. If you catch me in a farm, you sound your alarm. Bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed.
Oh, Israelite,
sir. Step my wife and my kids to get back up and not leave me. Darling, she said that was yours to receive.
Oh, Israelite,
sir. Look, you chucked them a tear up choices ago. I don't want to end up like Bonnie and
Desmond Dekker and the Israelites here on your program, Happy Station, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, before we took a listen to that, I said we're going to be talking about intelligence. And there seems to be a lack of it in the world today, but I don't mean that kind of intelligence. I'm talking about, you know, spy stuff, James Bond stuff, but not fiction, an actual real story. Now, many of you may remember the recent film, The Imitation Game, that starred Benedict Cumberbatch, which is about Alan Turing, who was a mathematician who was able to crack the Nazi codes during World War II. Now, this was an organization, they were located at Bletchley Park in the UK, and they were credited for helping the war end a lot quicker than it did. But there were two other secret organizations that were not in the UK, but they were located in Australia. And their job was breaking the military codes of the Japanese military. And it was staffed by a whole bunch of people, mathematicians, brilliant cryptographers, those who spent some time in Japan. And there's a new book that has come out called Codebreakers, Inside the Shadow World of Signal Intelligence in Australia's Two Bletchley Parks. Its author is Craig Colley, and I had a chance to speak to him this past week.
The Crimes Act, everyone thought, required people to keep their oath of secrecy that they made during the war, and the military had imposed it on people anyway. It was only after the spy catcher case, Peter Wright, who was had published a book, or was they were trying to publish a book about spying in the UK, where the UK government attempted to stop the book being released, but failed. That was, 30 or 40 years after the war.
When you take a look at it, what was the importance of having Codebreakers in Australia?
The importance was knowing, the importance of Codebreakers anywhere is anticipating the strategic decisions of the enemy, in this case the Japanese. It was in the Battle of Coral Sea and even more in the Battle of Midway, where the Allies had that advantage. They had broken into the Japanese naval codes. The Japanese had assumed that their codes were impregnable and were certainly unaware that their codes had been penetrated.
Right. I mean, we all know, of course, that codes are very important. I mean, there's even a couple of films they made about what was going on in the UK and about Alan Turing. Why are codes so important? Also, you know, why did it take so long for this information to come out?
I suppose because of the 30-year hiatus after the war. Then when that was eventually was no longer the case, people were to... It'd been too long ago. But for whatever reason, a lot of the people who were there sort of felt that they should keep it secret anyway, notwithstanding that the law didn't require them to as much as had been assumed.
So what you're saying is Australians don't like to brag very much.
No, we're not sort of braggarts. The Americans who had code-breaking units not only in Australia but which were Americans who'd come from the Philippines at the beginning of the war. There was a unit in Hawaii and a unit in Washington. They're better known because Americans are more likely to talk about what they've done, I guess.
But they weren't really that successful compared, let's say, to the British or the Australians.
No, they took credit for some of the success of the groups in Australia, in fact. With the Battle of Midway, Yamamoto, the commander of the Japanese Navy, had sent coded messages to his fleet commanders to position them for what was supposed to be the ambush of Midway. That coded message was first picked up and decoded by an American working in Melbourne. That was passed to the Hawaiian unit when they had done as much as they could for them to fill in the gaps. Because that's where Nimitz was operating out of, the commander of the Pacific Fleet. And the Hawaiian units didn't tell Nimitz that the stuff they presented to him had actually come from Melbourne, so it was always assumed, and that continued after the war, that the person who broke the code that led to the disaster for the Japanese at Midway had been based in Hawaii, but he was actually in Melbourne.
So why did they have two units? I mean, there was an American unit and an Australian unit. I mean, I would have thought that they would have shared information.
Well, that was the idea. They were in the same building in Melbourne, unless you talk about the Hawaiian and Melbourne units separately. They were there just to pick up signals from different areas. But in Melbourne, there were in the same building an Australian unit that had been in existence before the Pacific War broke out, and an American unit that had been based on Corregidor in the Philippines and been evacuated and set up again in Melbourne when the Philippines fell to the Japanese.
But with the two units working, did they work close together?
Not the one in Melbourne. There were two independent code-breaking units in Australia during the war. The Naval one in Melbourne, which was the original one, an Army Air Force one that MacArthur set up when he got sick of the poor service he's getting from the Navy one. And they followed him up to Brisbane and then on to New Guinea and the Philippines as he moved in that direction.
Were there different types of codes to work on? I mean, good stuff, okay stuff, and then really bad stuff?
Yes, that's not a bad description. There was a main code called JN25 that was the main one that the Japanese Navy used. There were other codes that were used by the submarines and by the transport fleets. The main one, the JN-25, Fabian insisted that only Americans should work on that, even though they had in that building the Australian who was by far the most experienced with Japanese naval codes.
But, you know, my question is because, I mean, it's just codes. You can literally be everywhere. Why were the codes broken in Australia?
Because the unit doing them had moved to Australia. The unit, there were... The Americans had units in three places, Washington, Hawaii, and the Philippines. When the Japanese successfully invaded the Philippines, or in advance of that, the Americans got their code breakers out of the Philippines. The last thing they wanted was for them to be captured and under coercion or torture, if you like. The Japanese would have found to their surprise that their code had been penetrated. They moved to Melbourne because MacArthur moved to Melbourne.
So for the message intercepts, was this done by field people or was it actually done by, you know, people, let's say, in Melbourne, or was it a combination of both? I mean, did the field people just pass the information on to Melbourne where the codes were broken?
They intercepted the message. They weren't breaking the codes. The codes were already broken by the main units in Brisbane. They had the codes to the extent that they were broken when they were local codes, like local command codes, where you wanted to know, for instance, whether you were about to be attacked. You couldn't afford to send that to Brisbane to be decoded and then come back again. So they decoded those messages on the spot. Where they picked up more strategic planning messages from Japanese high command, they sent them to Brisbane. Amongst other things, they had to break into the code first, and the people who did that were in Brisbane.
Now, what about the future stuff? I mean, how did they obtain information, let's say, on a future attack?
They were intercepts. They were just intercepts of messages sent by high command. The messages were intercepted, then sent, recoded in the Allied code, and sent by radio down to Brisbane.
So what I'm trying to work out now is, where was the message sent from, where was it sent to, and where was it intercepted?
Okay, they would have been sent, say, from Rabaul to the command in New Guinea. They would have had, the Australians would have had an aerial somewhere in the jungle in New Guinea and were able to pick up this radio signal.
What about Sydney? Did they have any code breakers?
My understanding was that they were encoders of the Allied signals. The Japanese were sending their signals amongst their different command centres in their codes. The Allies sent signals from, say, Sydney in this case, to Washington or London in the Allied codes. And my understanding was that the units in Sydney were encoding the Allied signals with the Allied code.
What sort of people became codebreakers?
A funny mix. The last gentleman's right in that they did look for people with some sort of mathematical expertise. The most successful of them weren't necessarily mathematicians at all. I suppose they were just looking for some reason to recruit people. But it just seems the people who were good at it just had a knack at it for whatever reason. Eric Nave, who was by far the most experienced of the Australian code breakers, was not a mathematician. He, in fact, had joined the Navy after he left school. He did a course in Japanese because it was required then. This is around about 1910. And he looked at the various languages that he could have done, and they paid more for Japanese than, say, German or Italian. So he did a Japanese course, proved to be quite good at the language, went to Japan for 2 years to learn it and the culture, and then came back and to the Navy and sort of moved into codebreaking from there. This was in the 20s.
Is there any idea of how many codes there were? I mean, if you break one, is it easy to do the next one, or is it always changing? I mean, what about that?
If you've got codes, you don't run them forever because you're increasing the chances of them being penetrated. So the Japanese, as we would have too, changed their codes about every 6 months. Their codes were double encoded from code books, so every 6 months they would issue new code books to the various receiving areas. And when that happened, whatever progress you'd made in the last code ceased to be any good, and you had to start the process again of penetrating the new code. The more you did that, the more you had an idea of what might have made up the codes. You knew, for instance, by then that they had been double encoded. They encoded with a 5-digit number for each value, if you like, each word or each syllable, and then had a book of random figures, five-digit numbers that they added to each one of those.
All right. I mean, so you have a room full of people. They're all, you know, writing down codes and everything on pen and paper. But what kind of tools did they use for this kind of work?
One of the main tools, and one of the reasons that they were so successful, is that they had these IBM tabulators, which were like primitive computers, and they could run options rapidly through these machines and about 10 times the speed you could do it manually. And they were looking for patterns, basically.
Did they ever use interrogation as a way to get codes?
Yes, I guess so. The advantage of interception is that you don't need to have a Japanese with you. You're just listening to signals that are just running through the ordinary course. Intelligence officer, and they were attached to the various units out in the field, and they would have been analysing the messages that had been intercepted and decoded, and just applying them, sort of, if you like, drawing the strategic information.
Now, I presume at the time, of course, there weren't that many people that spoke Japanese. Would that mean that these people actually had to learn Japanese?
That's right, yeah. The intelligence officer would be working with what someone else had translated from the decoded Japanese, if you like, into English. But it was often in sort of radio jargon, so he would have to interpret that, interpret the significance of it, because you send short messages rather than long messages in various sort of shorthand, if you like. So there was quite a deal of analysis and insight that had to be applied to the raw message.
Was it only Japanese codes that Australia was working on?
Yes, because the Japanese were who we were at war with at that time in Australia. Obviously, over in Europe, people were cracking the German codes, and particularly the famous Enigma machine. Hmm. The Germans had a machine encoding. The Japanese had codebook encoding. Only the Japanese diplomatic codes were machine encoded, but the Japanese didn't tell their diplomats anything. The military had no time for them.
Well, given the fact that this wasn't really talked about then, and it's only, of course, recently that we're actually starting to learn about this, what about after the war? Did they get any type of recognition at all?
No, it was to be kept secret. Because the Allies continued with their code-breaking exploits because there was a new enemy, namely the Soviet Union. And the people who had been in these units during the war, some of them went back to civilian life, but others remained in that area in signals intelligence, and they were the core, if you like, of a new group that was set up secretly, the Defence Signals Directorate, DSD, and no one knew of their existence till about the late 70s or the 80s. They also drifted into ASIO, which was intelligence, but not specifically signals intelligence. That ASIO was known of, but the DSD, which was specifically signals intelligence, was unknown until the 80s.
How secret were these people in that? I mean, how well did they keep the secret not to talk about it?
They did. They didn't even tell their spouses at the time what they were working on. They just say they're on some sort of clerical job, so that prevented it from being spread. And even after the Spycatcher case had shown that they couldn't legally maintain the oath of secrecy, most of them kept to it anyway.
Craig, you know, it is an absolutely fascinating book. It must have been interesting and a lot of fun to research.
It was hard work because the information is tucked away in sort of dark corners of the internet or in sort of self-published little memoirs and things. They sometimes contradict each other, so you've got to decide which one is the more likely. So it was sort of a long but ultimately rewarding task, I hope.
Well, Craig, actually, thank you very much for joining us today. Craig Colley is the author of a book called Codebreakers, Inside the Shadow World of Signal Intelligence in Australia's Two Bletchley Parks. Craig, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
By the way, it's a book that I would suggest you go and pick it up. It is rather fascinating, especially if you're interested in this kind of subject, because it really is it's a real story. It's absolute history, and it's one of my favorite things of all time, actually, reading historical books, and this is one that I certainly enjoyed reading when I had the time, picking it up and putting it down. It was actually more picking it up and keeping it up and reading the whole thing. All right. You are listening to Happy Station, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Time for music again. Here's Natasha Atlas with Mon Ami La Rose, My Friend the Rose.
On est bien peu de choses, et mon ami la rose me l'a dit ce matin. À l'aurore je suis née, baptisée de rosée, je me suis épanouie, heureuse et amoureuse, au rayon du soleil, me suis fermée la nuit, me suis réveillée billée. Pourtant j'étais très belle, oui, j'étais la plus belle des fleurs de ton jardin. Besoin d'espoir, sinon je ne suis rien.
The Pata Pata song, performed by Paul Morin and his orchestra. And before that, Natasha Atlas and Mon Ami La Rose, My Friend The Rose. Pata Pata, by the way, is, of course, a very well-known song by Miriam Makeba. I was actually planning on playing the original, but for some reason we didn't have it with us today in the studio. Anyway, that does not matter. Before we go, I just want to remind you again about our Patreon page, patreon.com/PCJRadio. There's a lot of very rare material there, and material that, well, only those who are patrons will have a chance to hear, as well as some special stuff that we actually have coming up for patrons very, very soon. Before we end off with our final piece of music today, you may remember that I was telling you about our new website that was coming. I say was coming May 1st. It still is coming, but we're actually a little bit behind schedule, as you probably are aware. But if you just go to pcjmedia.com and click on the PCJ logo, you can still access all the programs in the meantime. It's a little bit too complicated to get into why we didn't begin it on March 1st. But actually, it's a good thing. It's a good thing that we actually, because we needed the extra time. So, you know, it's one of those, it just happens, you know, just happens. Anyway, we're going to leave you today with Dolly Parton, who is a singer and songwriter, with one of her hits. Many of her songs have been covered by other people, and the one we are going to listen to is called Coat of Many Colors. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. Saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again. Back to the seasons of my youth. I recall a box of rags that someone gave us, and how my mama put the rags to use. There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small, and I didn't have a coat, and it was away down in the fall. Mama sewed the rags together, so in every piece with love she made my coat of many colors that I was so proud of. As she sewed, she told a story from the Bible she had read about a coat of many colors Joseph wore, and then she said, perhaps this coat will bring you good luck and happiness. And I just couldn't wait to wear it, and Mama blessed it with a kiss. My coat of many colors that my Mama made for me, made only from rags, but I wore it so proudly. Although we had no money, well, I was rich as I could be. In my coat of many colors my mama made for me. So with patches on my breeches and holes in both my shoes, in my coat of many colors I hurried off to school, just to find the others laughing and making fun of me. In my coat of many colors my mama made for me. And oh, I couldn't understand it, for I felt I was rich, and I told them all the love my mama sewed in every stitch. And I told them all the story Mama told me while she sewed, and how my coat of many colors was worth more than all their clothes. But they didn't understand it, and I tried to make them see that one is only poor, only if they choose to be. Now I know we had no money, but I was rich as I could be. In my coat of many colors my mama made for me. made just for me.